How many of us grew up reading tales of the Arabian Nights, seeing illustrations of snake charmers, mysterious veiled women, watching I Dream of Jeannie? Part of my ministerial formation included studying world religions and Islam in particular. There was so much I needed to learn and unlearn about it. So many of my own references were filled with images of that mysterious, exotic, veiled female figure in the harem, completely devoid of agency, the caricature of a woman in I Dream of Jeannie that was a slave and obeyed her master, but who wore really cute clothes and could make herself tiny and live inside a bottle, but also, with a blink of an eye, could take herself anywhere in the world. And yet she always came back and made herself small and went inside the bottle as smoke. She always came back to her master. Insert canned laughter. My introduction to a serious examination of women, gender, and Islam was a course in divinity school, and as we read and engaged in lively classroom discussions, I became aware of how limited my own identity as a feminist, as a woman, as a religious person was. Those categories of woman, feminism, and Islam in my mind were very narrow. We're very Western, and I found myself, even before we broke open the first book, I already had an attitude that I was more liberated, I knew more freedom, maybe I should help them get some freedom. Ouch. Yeah, that's where I was. And in the process of opening up my understanding of these categories, I was challenged to ask myself, what did I really know about women in Islam, and who put those ideas and images there, and when? What do I see, what do I feel when I see a photograph or I am in front of a real woman wearing a burqa or a hijab? Is Islamic feminism an oxymoron, a contradiction in terms? What is Islamic feminism? Dr. Margot Badran defines Islamic feminism as gender equality and is part and parcel of the Quranic notion of the equality of all human beings. Islamic feminism calls for the implementation of gender equality in the state, civil institutions, and everyday life. It includes the right and need for personal moral authority, challenging dogma, freedom from violence, and even the creation of inclusive mosques and expressing egalitarian ideas through Islamic music as a means of worship and resistance. Islamic feminists insist on employing principles of contextual analysis of the Quran. So this has a theological root. In divinity school, I learned that the term Orientalism was coined in 1978 by Edward Said, who defined it as a way of seeing that imagines and emphasizes, exaggerates, if you will, differences of the societies and cultures that inhabit Asia, North Africa, and the Middle East as compared with Europe or the United States. Orientalism is seeing their cultures as exotic, backwards, uncivilized, and at times even dangerous. Orientalism dates from the period of European Enlightenment and colonization of the Arab world. It provides a rationalization for European colonialism based on a self-serving history in which the West constructed the East as extremely different and inferior, and therefore in need of Western intervention or rescue. Some of the first 19th century Orientalist paintings were intended as propaganda in support of imperialism, depicting the East as a place of lawlessness, barbarism, only enlightened and tamed by colonial rule. The material production of images from the perspective of the colonizers for the pleasure of the European male gaze make visible colonial fantasies of penetrating the harem and gaining access to Arab women's private places. In the United States, the World's Fairs in Chicago in 1893 and in St. Louis in 1904 helped to reinforce Orientalist imagery and the political ideology that justified colonial control and subjugation. Those images are still shaping how we view our Muslim brothers and sisters, how we construct the so-called East or Orient. So where do our own presuppositions and stereotypes about Muslim women come from? And how do we react when we see a woman wearing a veil, especially if we identify as a feminist? According to my professor Leila Ahmed, the British occupation began in Egypt in 1882. British colonial domination and policies determined access to economic resources and shaped cultural attitudes. The issue of women and the discourse on the veil emerged during the latter part of the 19th century as Europeans established themselves as colonial powers in Muslim countries. This discourse on the veil was deployed within a narrative of colonial domination. In 1899, writer Qasim Amin proposed a series of radical reforms for Muslim countries and in the Egyptian nation in particular, including the abolition of the veil. He regarded veiling as central to social transformation. Amin's assault on the veil is an example of an internalized colonial perception, but yet it marked the beginning of a new narrative and provoked the emergence of an Arabic narrative, a native narrative of resistance against the colonial powers. According to Ahmed, the veil came to symbolize the resistance narrative, not the inferiority of the culture and the need to cast aside the traditions of the native peoples in favor of the West, but on the contrary, the dignity and validity of all native traditions, and in particular those coming under the fiercest colonial attack, the traditions related to women, and the need to tenaciously affirm them as a means of resistance to Western domination. That blew my mind, that I first saw the veil as a sign of oppression, that it had to go, and I was buying the whole line that we needed to free those women, and that the first thing would be for them not to wear the veil. And here I'm learning that the veil became a means of resistance. For Ahmed, the feminist agenda as defined by Europeans was incorrect in its focus on the veil. When items of clothing, be it bloomers or bras, have figured as focuses of contention and symbols of feminist struggles in Western societies, it was at least Western feminist women who were responsible for identifying the item in question as significant and defining it as a site of struggle, and not, as has sadly been the case with respect to the veil of the Muslim women, colonial and patriarchal men like Amin, Cromer, and others, who declared it important to feminist struggle. To be sure, the debate over the veil continues amid competing discourses that either reinscribe the Western colonizing narrative or the narrative that calls for preserving Muslim customs as resistance to colonial imperialism, trapping the struggle for women's rights with struggles over culture. What Islamic feminism is and how it is lived is deeply complex. I couldn't do the subject justice in one sermon or one course. We would be here forever. But what I'm trying to do is give a glimpse of my own struggle with understanding and how I was challenged to shed those stereotypes and live with the tension and complexity as a feminist. This complexity is illustrated by Turkey's legal reforms, which replace Sharia family law with a code inspired by the Swiss family code, outlawing polygamy, giving women equal rights to divorce, and granting child custody rights to both parents. And at the same time, Turkish women have staged sit-ins and hunger strikes to demand the right to veil. Clearly, we need to allow ourselves to gain a more open and well-rounded understanding of what Islamic feminism is and the complex and diverse ways in which it is embodied. For example, how do we understand Black Muslim converts in the United States? What are the challenges and the joys and opportunities in Unitarian Universalism becoming a spiritual home to people who were raised Muslim or who are in a relationship with a Muslim person, raising children with several religious traditions, or whose daily devotional practices are inspired by Islam? How would we understand a UU wearing a hijab? This is an excerpt from Havidia Akwai's essay, From Islam to Unitarian Universalism. This was published in the UU World, the UU magazine. She wrote, "I did not begin to seriously question the religion I was taught until I reached my late teens. I pray to Allah fervently and love listening to accounts of the Prophet. While my love for Louisa May Alcott novels probably didn't conflict too much with my religious teachings, my favorite TV show was Star Trek: The Next Generation. The show inspired a desire for a future in which all things were possible, of which nothing had been written. As I became exposed to more and more Muslims and to the rise of an emerging strict interpretation of Islam known as Wahhabism in the United States, an uneasiness developed in my heart," she says. "Muslim injunctions against music, against living images, and against the free movement of females caused me grief. Although I was told and taught to have pride in myself as a Muslim woman, it did not look like pride to others. They read my modesty and bashfulness as repression. I watched other women in my community be marginalized for being outspoken. I came up against ugliness that belied the beautiful aspect of Islam I had been taught by my parents. I had dreamt that I would be Muslim until and beyond my last breath, but the dream was fading." She says, "I lost my faith. I had been reading the Tao Te Ching for a few years and began to carry that little book in my purse next to my pocket Quran. It gave me solace too. Finally, I made the leap to Unitarian Universalism while searching for a philosophy that allowed me to identify and live my deepest values. Many Black American converts, like my parents, embraced Islam as a way of being fully themselves and fully engaged in their community. I joined the First Unitarian Church in Portland because I remain a community-oriented person. Since the events of September 11, people all around the world have looked for examples of progressive Islam. Islam seemed to put me in a box. And she asks, does Unitarian Universalism put me into a box too? The Islam I experienced did not always lift me up as a Black American girl. Does Unitarian Universalism lift me up? Can I lift me up as a Black Latina who doesn't believe in God so much? Where are the UU traditions that celebrate my culture, my ancestors? And she ends by saying, when I feel at odds with the company I keep, I can speak up. Possibility is always present. The future is open to us. That is a faith I can embrace. End quote. Beloveds, the next generation of Unitarian Universalists is always emerging, always seeking alternative ways of seeing ourselves, each other, and the world. We are not about putting people into boxes or categories. Our shared journey is about questioning, seeking, heading into that unknown with courage and humility in our quest for wholeness, for reaffirmation of our right to be our authentic selves, and most of all, to experience being loved unconditionally. May we be so bold as to break through every box, every stereotype, every attempt to distance us from each other. In faith and in love, there are no final frontiers, only infinite possibilities for us to catch a glimpse of the holy in each other's eyes. Inshallah, may it be so. Blessed be.